again, everyone, and welcome to the Stick to Wrestling podcast. My name is John McAdam, and I am here with Sean Goodwin, my co-host. Sean, how are you doing?
Fantastic, and a beautiful summer day here in Massachusetts, New Hampshire for you, New England. That covers everything.
Yeah, I am like literally a walk from the Massachusetts line, so we're getting the same weather here. Before I forget to do this, and I always forget to do this, I'm going to do it at the top of the show right from now on. We have a Facebook group, Stick to Wrestling. Anyone who is a fan of this podcast is very likely going to enjoy that page. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, Stick to Wrestling. And I got asked this week on actually Jeff Bowdrin and Barry Rose's group, what's with the Stick to Wrestling? Is that a jab at the Breaking Kayfabe guys? Of course not. Barry's a friend of mine. Jeff has been a friend of mine for like 30 years. So, you know, I definitely would never want to stick it to them. The name of the podcast came from, there's a guy who has a really cool football Twitter. His name is Matt Miller. And if you like the NFL draft, follow him for sure. And he has a podcast called Stick to Football. And that comes from any time he says something social or political that people don't like, they always turn right around and say, "Hey, buddy, stick to football." So I actually DM'd him. I said, "Matt, I'm totally stealing this from you. I have a podcast that's going to be starting. Would you mind if I called it Stick to Wrestling?" And I also said, "This is the craziest question you're going to get all day." And he was cool about it. He's like, "Yeah, sure. Just, you know, make sure you don't claim it's affiliated with my show. But other than that, so that's where it came from."
So it is official now. It is not affiliated with that show.
We have made it perfectly clear, because I think there might have been some confusion. No, not really. That's... we had something to do with a Stick to Football podcast. But no, Matt, like I said, Matt's a cool guy, and he's a really good Twitter follow if you're into the NFL draft. So there we are. We're started. And one of the more popular segments on this show has been the What If segment. And on Twitter, someone suggested to me that we do one on what if 30 years ago, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard had never left Crockett for the WWF. What if they had stayed through that tumultuous time when they were transitioning from the company being owned by JCP, or Jim Crockett, excuse me, to being owned by Ted Turner and his enterprise? What do you think?
I think they got out with a get and was good. I don't think that, not just because of the quality of the product, but I just don't think that brand that it was about to become under Turner really fit them. I mean, they were more of a realistic product.
I agree with that. Go ahead.
There was a legitimacy to them. I mean, Tully wasn't, any kind of a superhero. He was just a jerk. I mean, that was it. That was Tully's whole gimmick. He was a jerk. He was a little weasel. Everyone knows a Tully Blanchard. You know, just that, just obnoxious. Oh, and where they were going with all their kind of just goofy gimmicks, and that was not going to be something. They would try to compete directly with Vince, and that kind of thing wasn't for them. I don't think they would have fit in the new product. I think it would have got worse.
I agree. And here's the thing, too. You know, this is 1988. No one in JCP knew what was going to happen next. There was a real chance that the company could just close down. And if that happened, would Ted Turner be interested in starting a wrestling company from the ground up? I have to question that. I mean, maybe he wanted the television. So maybe that would have happened, but you don't want a lot of maybes when it affects your livelihood, as it did with all of those guys. And the thought was that, if this ship sinks, there's only going to be so many lifeboats. Vince McMahon's not going to want every single one of those guys. And so as soon as Tully and Arn, got a solid offer, there's a lot more going on than that. They took off, and I think they did the right thing.
Plus, they were going to start clamping down on that budget. So the whole reason they left was not about to improve any.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the guys got sweet contracts from the new company that had guaranteed money. that actually had raises. You know, Crockett was behind in paying the guys, which is why Arn and Tully, their contracts had been breached. Almost everyone's contract had been breached, and you know they were free to go. It was pretty interesting. Like the WWF brings them in, and a lot of the so-called smart fans who read newsletters, they were like, "Wow, WWF should get Rick and Barry too, and have like Hulk Hogan against the Four Horsemen." And I would tell anyone who said that right away, there's no way Vince is going to do that. There's no way he's going to take a Crockett creation like that and put it over in such a manner. And it actually went even further than that. You know, Tully and Arn won the tag team titles, which is good. But at the same time, when they were in the WWF, they were just another tag team, just like the Rockers, just like the Killer Bees, just like, you know, et cetera.
I got a better example. They were kind of like in the WWF at that time. They were kind of like the Austin and Pillman in 93 in WCW. They had the same vibe. They got over despite.
I mean, you know, they got over at that level as, tag team champions. But at the same time, you know, Bobby Heenan brings them in and they name them after Bobby Heenan. So here you have two guys who were at the, I want to say the very top of the NWA, but they were an important part of their, number one by far heel faction. And then they come to the WWF, and like I said, they're just another tag team. And in the end, I think it made the NWA look even more minor league for no lack of a better word.
But they were just another tag team because of the way they were treated.
Yeah,
they weren't given any opportunities. That's why I was saying. That's why I compared them to the Blondes, because they got over just because they were good, not because of any favors they were given.
No, as a matter of fact, I mean, everyone talks about it. I mean, as soon as the Blondes, the wrong guys got over, they eventually just, napalmed them and broke up the tag team. But at least the Blondes got a main event on a Clash of the Champions special, which is a little bit more than Tully and Arn got.
Now, why do you put them with Heenan if you're not going to push them? I mean, why bother?
I think they functioned well from a WWF standpoint as, Heenan, as part of the Heenan family, maybe the fourth and fifth guys, down the totem pole. But I mean, and plus Heenan had never managed the tag team champions before, so they probably did it as a favor to him.
So how would you play it out then? Say if they stayed in WCW. I just think it gets worse for them.
I think it gets worse for everybody. And let me say this. I am a big fan of Arn Anderson. I am also a big fan of Tully Blanchard. And I'm going to say something horrible when I lead off with that. I think the NWA had gone as far as they were going to go with Tully and Arn on the roster. You could have... Okay, let's say they stayed in JCP or they stayed in the NWA. What would have happened with them? Well, I think when Flair turned, Arn would have turned with him, similar to the way that Dr. Death just turned with Ted DiBiase after Dick Murdoch injured him. And that would have been an effective role for Arn. As a matter of fact, when they brought him back a year later, he was really effective in that role. So Arn could have been – he actually was a good babyface. What do you do with Tully Blanchard in the meantime? Tully, you can't turn him, like you mentioned. He is what he is. I saw him briefly as a babyface in Southwest, and it's just not his
– It's horrible. He's a loathsome little puke.
Yeah.
That's what he does.
And that works really well when
he's
you're
a
professional wrestler. Yeah. I mean, one of the greatest visuals I ever saw in wrestling, and I got to see it for about a year every Saturday, was Tully out there with Baby Doll, who was a head taller than him. And he just he looked so ridiculous, but it was great because it's wrestling.
Well, he picked her, didn't he?
I'm not sure if he actually picked her in real life, or if Nicola was just, you know, her father was in wrestling, so maybe Crockett saw her on World Class, or Dusty saw her and said, hey, give her a chance. I have no real reason to think that Tully was watching World Class at the time.
Could Joe have known Nick Roberts?
It's possible. I'm more into thinking that, you know, Crockett saw her or Dusty saw her. I mean, Dusty was rebuilding the company from the ground up. I mean, he tore down the old Mid-Atlantic territory and rebuilt it. And I have a feeling he saw her and he said, hey, you know, let's bring her in.
So speaking of Dusty, you have the story of when Arn and Tully found out Dusty was coming back, right?
The WWF? I'll tell you what happened. I kind of half-assed knew Arn Anderson. He at least knew who I was. And I go over and say hi. And he says, come here, I want to talk to you for a minute. And we go into the restroom, the bathroom of the bar we were in. I suddenly find myself surrounded by Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, and Kirk Henning, who I had never met before. And here's the thing. If you think these guys look big on TV, you should see them in real life. I mean, Arn is huge and intimidating. And he says to me, Johnny Mac, what do you know about Dusty Rhodes coming here to the WWF? And I had been on the phone with Meltzer earlier that day. And I'm like, oh, he's coming. And the three of them were just disgusted. I have no words to describe how, like, ugh, these guys were. And Arn's exact words were, the whole reason I came here was to get away from that fucking asshole. I don't think he meant that literally, but, I mean, and we all know there was major heat towards the end between Dusty and Tully, and Dusty and Flair as well. I mean, as soon as Dusty came back in the beginning, was at the very end of 90, we all knew Dusty was going back to the NWA. And the question was, how long is Ric Flair going to last there? And the answer was less than 6 months. And it wasn't just Dusty, but it was a combination of things. But anyway, so I think that's what would have happened with Arn. He would have remained Rick's sidekick, even turning babyface. What happens to Tully? Well, now, here's the thing. Tully, I thought, was very stale at that point. You know, by the time he left in 88, I actually thought he and Arn leaving was a bit of a blessing in disguise. As a matter of fact, I think it turned out to be a blessing because Arn came back stronger than ever about a year later. But let's say Tully doesn't leave. You can have him not turn with Arn, not be sympathetic with to Ric Flair, not be sympathetic towards Arn turning, and maybe form an alliance with Terry Funk and the Great Muda and Gary Hart or whoever. That's one thing you could have done with them. Another thing, I don't know who with off the top of my head, but they were bringing in a lot of talent. You could have had Tully say, hey, this new guy is my protege and we're going to win the tag team titles, and just, you know, find some heel who's working World Class or Calgary, wherever, and put him in that role as you know, Tully mentoring him in a heelish way.
So basically the two national wrestling organizations with supposedly the finest minds in wrestling can't figure out a role for one of the greatest tag teams of all time. In their prime.
And, you know, I mean, what the WWF did with them was fine. I think, you know, they're not going to push a guy like Arn Anderson, like Tully Blanchard, because of his size, as major singles attractions. You know, if the tag team would not have left, let's say they had stayed in the WWF for 4 or 5 years and they eventually had to split them up, I think things would have gone badly for Tully, to be honest with you, because I just don't see the WWF giving him any kind of a singles push. Arn, on the other hand, there are multiple things you could do with him. Supposedly, when Arn left, Vince McMahon told him that, you know, hey, you're welcome back anytime. I think he still works there, so there you go.
Yeah. I mean, in the early 90s, he looks custom-made for the IC title.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. You know, and here's the thing. When Tully left I mean, he left the NWA, then about a year later, we all know what happened. He allegedly, he did flunk a drug test. It's been alleged that a lot of guys flunked drug tests, but only Tully got picked out because he was actively talking to guys in the locker room about maybe coming to WCW with him. And Tully's career effectively ended, which was amazing if you think about it.
How much of a boost would it have been to more specifically Arn, but Tully too, to have lasted to the end of WWF when the steroids thing happened?
Because
he went small at that point.
Yeah, Tully was small, and
yeah, he was extraordinary. Yeah, he was way small. That's why I didn't want to put him in there really. But Arn's different.
You know what though? I mean, if you look at both of their physiques, I mean, I'm speculating here. I want to keep Brian on a legal hot water. I strongly suspect they were both using steroids. I think Arn admitted it, as a matter of fact.
Well, that may be true, but they didn't have the look.
No, so I guess the question is, if these guys, if Tully looked the way he did, if he was on steroids, then what was going to happen when that candy got taken away?
Right, right, exactly. You know, that's what I'm thinking problem. About him. Right, but I'm looking more at Arn. Could you pitch us, like, okay, for the IC title, Bret Hart against Arn?
For sure.
Early 90s. Or Arn against Michaels.
Would have been interesting.
Yeah, so I actually think the more interesting question is, what if they stayed in the in New York?
That is an interesting question, and you're right. I can see Arn getting a major push once the tag team split up. Tully, not as much, but I'll tell you something. You know, despite him being, you know, really you can't use him as a babyface, he was absolutely awesome in the ring, and the WWF could always use a guy like that, even if he's just a mid-carder. Even that would have been better than what actually happened to him, whereas his career just went down the tubes.
Could you use him as a manager?
I think you could. The problem with managers is there are so many other guys you can use as managers that don't have another role. You know, if I have Tully Blanchard, I want to use him as a wrestler because he can actually get in the ring and fight as opposed to someone that can't, you know?
Yeah. To have him succeed, you would have had to create another division for him.
And I'm not going to create another division just for one guy.
No. Well, how much did he legit weigh?
I mean, he's small for a wrestler, but he was big for a regular guy. I'd say legit 220, 230.
Really? If he was that big.
Here. These are big guys, man. They are really. I have, you know, once the show comes out, I will put up, let's say, a picture of me at 175 pounds standing next to Rick Steiner. I mean, these guys are huge.
Well, yeah, but if. What was Brett? If Brett was around 230, wasn't he?
No, I would say Brett. I'd only been around Brett once. It was in 1989. And I would say he had to be legit 240, 250 range.
I have never heard him build that high.
These guys are way bigger than they appear on TV.
I always thought they were exaggerating the weights.
You know, not to you know, beat this horn, but I mean, where I grew up around New England Patriots football players, so I was used to seeing big guys. Then I see Steve King, the old WWF enhancement talent, pumping gas, and he is what's the word I'm looking for? He is wider than just about any player I had seen. Steve King was a short guy. I'd say he was like 5'7", 5'8", maybe. But, I mean, he looked like he could bench press, you know, anything you throw at him. So I remember that moment just being amazed. Like, wow, he's short, but he's stockier. That's the word I'm looking for, than an NFL player.
So I guess to answer the question, we basically think Arn might have a chance to be somewhat successful in WCW at the end of the day. Probably Tully's going to end up the same way either way.
Yeah, Tully... Like I said, what happened to him, I mean, was sad. I used to have a job where my wrestling friends would call me all the time from around the country. It didn't matter. And not in 1990 and 1991. Yeah, so I mean, you compare a wrestler that you just see in public and compare him to the average guy walking down the street. I mean, Steve King was huge. And like I said, I can compare him to an NFL player. So, and Arn Anderson wasn't short like Steve King. You know, Arn was a big guy. So, yeah, I mean, you can't underestimate how big these guys are.
So at the end of the day, basically, in either case, Arn's probably going to have a chance of, you know, doing pretty well, and Tully's going to get gigged in the whole thing just because of his size. Either way.
Here's the thing. Tully had a lifeboat, okay? WCW was constantly negotiating to bring Tully Blanchard back. And what happened was Tully flunked the drug test, and Jim Herd, and what a dirtbag move this is, he'd already hired the guys and had an amount that he agreed to pay them. Well, Herd says, oh, no, you flunked a drug test. You're worth less money now. And I thought that was absolute garbage. You either say, look, you flunked the drug test for these guys, I don't want you working here. Or you say, well, that happens someplace else. We have our own drug testing here. We'll sign the deal we agreed to. You don't just say, well, you're worth less money. Now that you've quit, let's renegotiate. That's ridiculous. And Arn wound up taking less money. And now Herd was supposedly saying to Tully, hey, I can't sign you for more money than Arn Anderson. That's your absolute ceiling now. And Tully wouldn't budge. And there was a time where they had an agreement to come in. It was right before the Clash of the Champions, February 1990. The idea was Tully was going to come in, rejoin the Horsemen, and an argument would ensue, and Sting would get turned on. That's why what you saw that night looked – I thought it looked really good, but it looked hastily put together. And they were constantly negotiating to bring Tully in, and I was constantly being asked, when's Tully coming? But had WCW brought Tully back, he would have had a home. I don't think they should have pushed him as hard as they pushed him in 85, but he definitely would have had a role there.
Fair enough. So one other topic we had discussed leading into the show was our favorite heel and face turns. And you asked me to put together a list of my favorite heel turns.
Favorite heel turn? Now, was it favorite or all right, we'll go with favorite. I actually had mine is most surprising. You can have best. That way we can, like, not be talking about the exact same thing. But
to my mind, it's the same thing.
Okay.
Because I need that kind of surprise. I mean, if it's something I see a mile away, what's the big deal?
Exactly.
So it has to have that element. It has to have two things. One, it has to have that element of surprise and that element of inevitability. Like after it happens, you're like, oh, of course.
Yeah. That's the thing. If you have a turn that makes absolutely no sense, then, I mean, that's surprising. It's surprising because it's stupid, you know. But then, and one of those is on my list. But before we get into that, there was a minor controversy. There was a match between Kenny Omega and what's Okada's first name?
Really? You're going to throw that one at me? Hold on.
We'll just go with the
former champion.
There we go. Omega versus Okada. There we go.
Yeah.
And Dave Meltzer, who I think the world of, gave the match 7 stars. Now, there was a controversy maybe a year ago when these two had apparently a wonderful match, and Meltzer gave it 6 stars. And it kind of destroyed my entire universe because I believe in the star rating system. And I've said this before, I think numbers are a language. And instead of saying, oh, that was a really, really, really good match, you can just give it 4.5 stars. And 5 stars, to me, was always the ceiling. Even though Dave gave a Ricky Steamboat versus Ric Flair match from Landover in 1989 5 stars plus.
Right.
So now the whole thing is skewed. This thing I've been using for 30 years has been warped. But actually, Dave was nice enough to Twitter back at me, and he had an explanation. I think it's a good explanation. He says 5 stars is match of the year. 6 stars is match of the decade. 7 stars is match of a lifetime. So I'm like, all right, if we do 1 7-star match per lifetime, I can live with that. If we do 1 6-star match per decade, but you only get one, I can live with that.
Okay, two things. The reason I forgot about this probably because, I don't know, I think the whole thing with the star system is a straight-up marketing tool. I think he's actually admitted that. Dave's admitted that in an interview with to Bix, our buddy, recently. Basically, it's just a straight-up marketing tool for him. And, hey, you know, God bless. That's fine. I think sometimes the viewers of the star, his readers, take the star system more seriously than he does.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have had debates with people about whether a match that we just saw at an arena was 3 3/4 stars or 3.5 stars. That's how much of a dork I am.
I mean, really, it's – okay, so let me get this explanation down again. 5 stars is match of the year.
Yep.
6 stars is – what was it? Match of a decade?
Match of a decade, yes.
Okay. And 7 stars is a match of a lifetime. Okay,
right.
So what happens if you get a 7-star match, and then you find a match that's better than that? Do we expand?
I think right before the referee counts 3, you die.
Does a black hole? Did we get hit with a meteor or something? What happens? I mean, we at this pace, we're going to be up to 42 stars. So I mean, it's like I think it's one of those things. It's a fun marketing tool for him. I think he says a joke. I actually went and watched this match. I have never seen this match before, so it was a great match. It was one of the rare matches you'll see where you never saw a mistake.
Huh?
You never saw anything. It was just everything was executed beautifully. My only problem is my problem with pretty much every match from this era. Now, I would say if I'm giving it, I would say somewhere between 4.5 to 5. And again, a fantastic match. Can't say enough about it. I'm picking this. But the reason – okay, a couple of things I have a problem with it. One is around 25 minutes in, Kenny Omega got this injury on his rib cage, and they sold it like he got shot. I mean, they were just like, oh, they're going to stop the man. Here comes the commission. It was like the old NWA. You know, I'm waiting for Sandy Scott to come running in. So all of a sudden, 2 minutes later, he does a plancha with a flip over the top rope. Dude, if you got broken ribs to the point where they're going to stop the match, you're not doing a plancha over the top and a flip over the guardrail. So,
yeah,
I mean, come on. Let's remember we have an injury here.
You know,
so that was one.
No, go ahead.
That was
that 4.5 stars.
Yeah.
That is not an insult. That is – he just called that an unbelievably great match. Like, 4.5 stars is the best match on a really good NXT show.
If you're going to sit there and tell me this is the greatest match of all time, I'm picking nits. And I'm going to sit there and find every little thing I can find. Because if you're telling me this match is better, I've always said my favorite match of all time – and everyone thinks I'm nuts, but that's fine – is Jackie Fargo and Al Green in 72, the best 2 out of 3 fall hair match.
Okay, that's your 7-star match. All right.
No, I don't believe in the 7-star match. I think that's ridiculous. But it's my 5-star match, yes, because I think the story told in that match was phenomenal. It was just phenomenal. That was my problem with the Omega match, is that they didn't have that great real, you know, just that kind of binding story to it, like within the match. For example, do you remember when Brett and Owen were in the cage?
Uh-huh.
And Brett sold that knee the whole time. Like everything he did, he sold the knee.
Uh-huh.
Over and over and over again. He went into the second match, still sold the knee. That's how you do it. And the whole thing, so they always had a story. Or I remember one was Lawler and Bockwinkel.
That was a great
this
match.
This was a million times these guys going at it. So finally they decided to switch it. And what they did was they had Bockwinkel beat up Lawler so bad that the whole point was Lawler getting to the draw was the victory.
Right.
So,
okay.
That's – yeah. So as well as everything – technically this match was beautiful. I mean, everything was perfect. There wasn't a Sabu moment in the whole thing. And, you can't get that in a 15-minute match today. Never mind 64. So it had a nice pacing, a really great match, but that was really my only problem with it. And again, it's a minor thing. I'm still saying 4.5 to 5 stars. If you tell me 5 stars, I'm going to argue with it. But yeah, I think he's almost tongue-in-cheek. You know, 7 stars, he gets it. Hey, we're talking about it, aren't we?
Good point. A lot of people are talking about it.
And he did his job.
By the way, I will make it a point in the very near future to watch both of those matches. I will actually figure out how to... you know what? Oh, man. It's right before football season, and I shouldn't be subscribing to New Japan World or anything like that, but maybe I'll just do it for a month so I can watch these things. But here's my struggle with the 7-star system that has just been introduced to me. The two greatest matches I have ever seen are, I'll do them in chronological order, Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat from Chi-Town Rumble in 1989, and then the subsequent rematch from Nashville in May 1989.
Yeah, I've always said the 2 out of 3 fall, too. Yeah, the second one.
Yeah, I wasn't as into the two out of three fall. I thought that was a great match, but it wasn't. Huh. I didn't think it was up there with those two.
Oh, I love that match. But anyway, go ahead.
All right. So on most days, I pick the Nashville match, but some days I pick the Chicago match because the finish was so good, and the finish meant something to me. But anyway... So let's say I give the Nashville match 7 stars. I say that's the match, favorite match of all time. That's my match of a lifetime. Well, you've got the second best match. Okay, well, I can call this match of the decade 6 stars. Nope, same decade. So the Nashville match is both my match of the decade and my match of a lifetime. So now the Chicago match can only be 5 stars. And there is not 2 stars. The Nashville match was not 2 stars better than the Chicago match. So I'm all messed up. Dave has messed up my wrestling star ratings universe over here. I'm all confused.
You know him better than I do, so I will defer that point. But I have to guess from the little I've seen that if he's listening to us talk right now, he's laughing his rear end off.
You might be right. I don't know.
It just seems like, oh, my God, I can't believe these guys take this seriously. It's a 5 scale. You know, if he wants to say 6-star, whatever, 7-star match, it's kind of like saying, you know, when a professional athlete's going 140%. No, he's not. He's really not.
That's my argument.
It's a math. The thing was set as 5. It's 5. If he wants to tongue in cheek, jokingly say this is 7 or this is 42 stars or whatever, it's his star system, I guess. Actually, it isn't his star system. Let's get Jim Cornette on the phone.
I was with Dave, not the night of the Tom Robinson benefit in 1990. There was a show the night after that. And on the show, they had a really good match between Jerry Lawler and Terry Funk. And you know, we were having a ball watching it. And the guy, a couple of seats next to us after the match is over, puts up all 5 of his fingers. And me and Dave are like, no. It's a great match. 4.25, 4.5, not 5. And the 3 of us, I think there was more than 3 of us, like we're going at it as far as like what the star rating was. And Dave was right in the middle of it. So either he did a good job acting or, you know, he takes it seriously too.
Well, I have a way to now, isn't the inventor Jim Cornette and Norm Dooley?
Jim Cornette says it was Norm Dooley who created it. That's correct.
Okay. Is Mr. Dooley among us?
I believe so. I think he's just not into wrestling anymore, but he's still with us.
Is there any way we can get a deciding opinion from Mr. Dooley? He is the inventor.
An opinion as far as can there be 7 stars?
Yes. If you make a judgment on the Constitution, what do? You go to the original gods. I think we should do the same thing for the star system. Go to Norm Dooley and Jim Cornette. If they say it's okay, then we're fine.
Yeah, I don't know if Cornette is even in touch with him anymore. I think he mentioned that either he wasn't or he was barely in touch with him on a Jim Cornette experience for maybe a year or two ago. But anyway, I mean, you know, it's to me, it's Dave who popularized it, so he can kind of do what he wants with it. But I mean, I know, like, when I look at someone who rates movies and they use the star system, it only goes up to 5 stars. I mean,
that's where they stole it from.
I'm sure they didn't steal it from the Wrestling Observer newsletter.
No. I reverse. That's where, like, the wrestling guy stole it from, because that's where the movie did that. Like, Rex Reed did that for years.
Okay, that's
like way back, like in the 60s and 70s.
That's
so I think
cool,
Jim.
Though.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Jim Cornette actually conceded that. He said that we used to remember seeing movies rated with so many stars. So we're like, oh, we should do that for wrestling matches too.
That is beyond cool that we're taking the quality of a pro wrestling match and applying it to the same Rex Reed system that used to exist in the 60s and 70s. I love that.
In my mind, it works out perfectly. That's why I like that's why I always say the Fargo and Green match, and everyone thinks I'm nuts. But as far as just quality entertainment and just a great story and just a visceral crowd, I mean, that crowd's out of its mind. I mean, you hear them. It's like Banshee screaming when Fargo gets pinned.
I've seen that match.
And the best part was the ending. I've never seen it before, but the ending was that Jackie had this head injury in the second fall. They get to the third fall. No one thinks he's going to make it out. He makes it out. Al's beating the crap out of him. Finally, he comes back and he throws one last punch, drops Al, then he collapses.
I got to watch right before football season. My life is difficult.
Oh, I love that match. It's just everything was just the crowd. It was just that perfect storm. Everything worked in it. So, yes, that's my – wait a minute. One other problem with the star – with changing the star system. Now are we going back to fix all the rest of the matches?
Well, we're only going to be fixing, like, two matches. I mean, if you're going back to the 70s, you're only changing – I want to say 5 matches. You're giving.
Oh, no. It's not that easy, because now you're changing the perspectives. And all of a sudden, a 3-star match, which is compared against the greatest matches of all time, is only compared against the greatest matches of that year. So now maybe it's 4.
I don't see that. I just see it as, you know, a 3-star match is a 3-star match in 86 and 96. It's the same thing.
No, it can't be. Not if you're expanding it to 7 stars.
No, because the 7 stars thing, it's like the exception. Out of all the hundreds of thousands of matches out there, you're only applying that to 3, 4, 5 matches.
But you can't do that, because now you're changing what a 5-star match is. A 5-star,
no.
I cannot believe we're talking this long about this. A 5-star match is a match of the year, as opposed to the match of what it was before, which is a match of a lifetime, kind of. There was only like a certain amount of 5-star matches, like a 5-star general. You don't have them all the time.
You could have more than one 5-star match in a year. I've done it in a calendar year. And you know what? Truth be told, in 1988, God, I am taking this way too seriously. I did not think there was one single 5-star match. But you can't just give a match 5 stars because it's match of the year, and someone's got to be match of the year, so someone's got to be 5 stars.
Right. Exactly.
But
and now
I
all of a sudden, when you didn't
generally say,
no, I that skews the whole system. if you're gonna take this ridiculous thing to its logical conclusion, that means you have to go through the history of all of wrestling and restart every match. And if Mr. Meltzer wants to be responsible for that,
I'm never gonna get to watch football.
Actually, that's a perfect job for you.
Episode.
That's a perfect
right.
job for you.
If it was a job, I'd love it. All right, so let's hear it. What is your favorite babyface turn of all time?
Okay, favorite babyface. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now,
heel turn. I misspoke. Heel turn.
Yeah. Heel turn. Okay. My favorite heel turn is, and this is basically just for the turn. I mean, there were other parts, but the actual turn itself is DiBiase against JYD.
That was a start.
And it has nothing to do with DiBiase, and it has nothing to do with JYD. Why I love this so much. I love this so much because of the Oscar-winning performance as announcer of one Robert Roop.
Yep.
Bob Roop was – so basically Bob had a feud with DiBiase coming into this match. And the match was supposed to be Roop against DiBiase, but JYD beat Roop for the belt. So all of a sudden it turned to DiBiase against JYD, who are buddies.
JYD was Ted DiBiase's best man at his wedding. And
something which was, Roop brings up.
Yeah, which was real, by the way. It was real, yep. But they brought it into the storyline.
So all of a sudden, they're about to, so they both do the, you know, the babyface match on TV. Okay, so you know something's happening.
Well, let's throw this in too.
Yeah.
Ted DiBiase demanded a title match against Bob Roop.
Yep.
And if Bob, and he was like, if Bob Roop wins, I will pack my bag. If I lose this match, I will pack my bags and leave Mid-South. So right. Now we have the switch where JYD is the North American champion.
Yep.
And DiBiase's got all this pressure on him.
Right. So they both give the promo that they all give, you know, the baby face, we're buddies, not a problem, you know, straight up, we're going to play this clean. And Roop is screaming the whole time. He's like, do not trust DiBiase. I am telling you right now, the whole time he's going. So finally, the glove comes out, DiBiase turns.
Yep, DiBiase loads the glove, which Bob Roop had injured, and DiBiase had to tape up, and Ted DiBiase is like, hey, I have to wear this glove on top of the tape because my hand gets sweaty and the tape comes off.
And I can hear Roop now, just with just enough smugness. Oh, what a guy. How's your guy there, Boyd? Yeah, I told you all along, the best man at his wedding.
that
was the tone. It was fantastic. Why has Bob Roop not been used as an announcer since then? Just from that one performance, he's one of my all-time favorite heel announcers.
Yeah, Roop was screaming indignantly, that's what he had planned for me.
Yep, he had that planned for me, but he did it to his buddy. Best man. I just remember the snarl he almost said it with, the best man at his wedding. I cannot watch that enough. If you know that, it just, if you haven't seen it, go see it. I'm sure it's on the network.
I think it's on the network. I'm not 100% positive. Oh wait, no, but we watched it on the network. What am I talking
We did
about?
Watch it. That was my request, because we were insisted that I wanted to see that turn. But yeah, that's just one of the just one of those great wrestling moments. So,
do you remember who DiBiase wrestled the next week? It was like some mid-card babyface guy, someone who won sometimes but not all the time. I think it was Tom Jones.
Okay, Tom Jones from Detroit.
I mean, he wrestled Mid-South too. I think it was Tom Jones,
okay.
And they're wrestling, and DiBiase loads the glove, and he knocks Tom Jones out and gets the pin. And DiBiase just gets up, and he has this look on his face, this smirk, like, screw all of you. And Watts was perfect. He was just like, look at the defiance on Ted DiBiase. He's different now.
Yeah. If you just listen to Bob. Bob was telling you all along, as he's happy to let you know. So, that, just for the moment, that's my favorite. What's your number one?
My number one, and I'm leaning towards most surprising babyface turns. And this one took place on October, it aired on October 21st, 1978. Because I know this because I lived in Massachusetts, but I was visiting New York. So I was watching the Midnight Show on WOR, and they had the tag team main event, and we didn't get too many main events on WWF TV back then. You know, mostly it was usually five or six squash matches, but they had Bob Backlund and Peter Maivia, who were aiming for the tag team titles held by the Yukon Lumberjacks, wrestling Spiros Arion and Victor Rivera. And I wonder if they did that on purpose, like two guys managed by Blassie who were baby faces but had turned, I think Arion turned in 74 and Rivera had just turned in 78. And I did not pick up on it. Peter Maivia, why is Bob Backlund aiming for the tag team titles? Isn't he busy enough as WWF champion, which he's only held for like 8 months?
You would think.
Why? Go ahead.
No, I said you would think.
You would think.
Yep.
And why is Peter Maivia suddenly growing this rather nefarious-looking mustache? He's looking a little bit heelish here with this thing on his face. But I am, what, 13 years old, and I don't pick up on it. And suddenly, out of nowhere, it seemed, Peter Maivia became quite uncooperative with both Bob Backlund and his manager, Arnold Skoland. And they did a thing where Backlund was getting the crap beat out of him, and he finally managed to tag out to Maivia. Maivia was in the match for like 30 seconds and tagged right back out. Skoland starts yelling at him. Maivia just starts pounding on Skoland, and we have a feud. Now, I had been watching WWF wrestling, wrestling in general, for like 2.5-3 years, and I had never seen a turn before. They had not done a turn at all. I'd read about them in magazines, but I'd never actually seen one. And I was so pumped up. This aired at, like, it was the last match, so by the time it's over, it's 1 a.m. And I was so pumped up, I did not go to sleep until around 4 or 5 a.m. I was, you know, my mind was blown by seeing it and just thinking about the possibilities, you know, oh, I guess my V is going to feud with Backlund now. I don't know. But that was the most surprising turn I had ever seen.
Didn't my V do a number on the Chief, too?
2 days later at Madison Square Garden, my V and Strongbow are challenging the Yukon Lumberjacks for the tag team titles. The turn had already aired, obviously, in New York. And, you know, Strongbow is obviously quite wary of Mr. Maivia, who is, you know, now we don't know where he is. And Maivia just kind of walked out in mid-match, and Strongbow took a beating. And Strongbow and Maivia had been teaming for like a year and a half.
Now, for those who'd seen Peter in other places, in New York, Peter was never really, he was always kind of a oddly, if you look at the stuff before now, he's oddly portrayed as kind of this goofy guy.
Yeah, he was. Vince couldn't say his name without telling us how happy-go-lucky he was. That's the
he danced after every match.
Yeah, he'd be doing babyface clown spots all over the place.
Yep, he looked nothing like you would ever see Peter Maivia anywhere else.
You know, I don't think I've ever seen him anywhere else. I got to take a look at some of that stuff. More stuff I got to watch right before football season.
Yeah, because supposedly, supposedly out in San Francisco, I mean,
I know
he was just a straight out tough guy.
Huh. I have some of that stuff laying around, so I'll have to check it out. So anyway, in New York, the wrestling program aired 2 weeks, or I should say in Boston, the wrestling show was 2 weeks behind the New York show. So I come home and I'm telling my friends, you know, what happened. And because I'm me, they don't believe me because I like telling people weird stuff, trying to get them to do stupid stuff based on misinformation. And, you know, I was like, yeah, right, get out of here until it actually aired.
So now, how did this draw him and Backlund?
From what I understand, Madison Square Garden drew either sellouts or close to it. I don't know what Philadelphia did. I know Boston never did Backlund Maivia. They did Bruno versus Maivia, but that did fine. So
was that one of the ones they expanded to a fourth?
No. No, okay. They did three matches in New York, culminating in a cage match.
The standard in to explain that, the standard in New York from like the late 60s into the 70s, into the 80s, through the 70s, into the 80s, would be the three-match set. The three-match garden set. So you do three garden shows in a row. The first one would be some kind of usually disqualification, the champion getting disqualified or getting beaten by a count-out. The second would just some kind of brawl, and then the third would be the payoff.
Right. Now, they only did this with the absolute top-of-the-line heels. George Steele didn't get three matches against Bob Backlund. But a guy like Morocco or Greg Valentine or Sergeant Slaughter, you're usually looking at the three-match set.
And if it got really over, every once in a while they'd slip in a fourth. Like Patterson got four, right?
Patterson got four, and he was the only one who got four against Bruno or Backlund or Pedro. And my friend Max Levy and I, this was like one of our greatest mysteries. I mean, we're going back to like 2002 here. You know, why did Pat Patterson get four matches against Bob Backlund at Madison Square Garden? And when Roddy Piper passed away, Dave Meltzer, his name again, said that Piper was supposed to get a match. Patterson was supposed to go three matches against Backlund, and then Roddy Piper was supposed to get a title match. And supposedly Vince McMahon Sr. took one look at Piper and just said, "Hey, this guy's too small. We're not, you know, we're not doing this with him." So they didn't know what else to do, and they brought in. I think no, wait, let me take that back. Piper was supposed to get two matches against Backlund. One of the matches was filled by Pat Patterson. The second was filled by Sweet Hansen.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I need a Swede. So.
You can't find anybody in that locker room.
Yeah.
Better than that stiff. He was bad when he was old. I mean, when he was old, I mean, now years ago, never mind at this point.
Yeah, he was a guy, I mean, you know, I knew enough about wrestling in 1979 where I knew who the stars were. And, I mean, Hansen used to be a big star in the Carolinas, like early 70s, but I knew he was just another guy down there now. And I was like, you know, what are they doing pushing this guy? But
yeah, what better qualification to, you know, headline in New York than being a main event in the Carolinas 10 years earlier as a tag team?
Yeah, I think they should have just found another guy. I don't know. I take my chances
with Roddy.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, both Vinces were very fixated on size. I mean, and Piper was considered relatively small in like 84. He was a lot smaller in 1979.
Yeah, that's true.
What's your number two favorite heel turn?
I have Hogan on the list, but I'm refusing to go there. So my next would be 1984, Wahoo against Flair.
Okay, Wahoo is my number three most surprising.
This made so much sense.
It just made
so much sense.
It makes sense. There was a great storyline.
This reminds me of the old rule of Terry Funk. The heel has to believe he's right.
Mm-hmm.
And Wahoo had a completely legitimate point.
He did.
He's like, you know, basically the point was that Flair had the title. At this point, Flair was a babyface coming off of Starrcade 83. And Wahoo, with, you know, Iago Tully Blanchard in his ear, is sitting there, and that's funny. Wahoo was so popular in the Carolinas, they had to put Tully with him to make sure the heel turn worked. Basically, Wahoo was like, why can't I get a title shot? It's not fair. I've been a headline guy for years, and none of you guys will give me a title shot because you're afraid of me. The man has a point.
Yeah, and you know, and that's the thing. It's not only that a good heel, has to believe every word he's saying, but most of the good heels, at least when heel turns start, you can kind of see where they're coming from.
Oh, you don't even have to. You don't have to believe anything you're saying. But you have to believe what you're doing is right. I mean, you're not like one of these villains with the little handlebar mustache twirling it at the end, you know? there has to be something there that you're like, you have a legitimate, in your head, you may be nuts, but in your head, you have to sit there and say, you know what, I have been wronged here, and I don't care how I'm going to get it back, I'm going to get it back.
Yeah. Something you see in real life.
Yeah, and it made perfect sense when you have Tully yapping in his ear the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sitting there looking at the scenario like, yeah, I see how this happened.
Now, to me, it was number three most shocking because this is – and I've talked about this before. This is Wahoo McDaniel you're talking about. He is a legend's legend in the Carolinas and Virginia.
Main event, headline face for 10 years up until then.
Yep. And he was a guy – you know, he helped build the territory. You know, it was him and Johnny Valentine and the Andersons, et cetera, that got that territory really rolling. But to me, and I've said this before, and I don't mean to repeat, I liked the storyline. I thought it made perfect sense that Wahoo turned. But it was a shock for the reasons I laid out. Like, it's Wahoo McDaniel. You can't believe that he's a bad guy. And like I said, I've said this before, there are some guys that you just don't turn, even if you have a good storyline, even if it's going to make money. Because to me, if you have been watching Mid-Atlantic Wrestling for 10 years and you can't trust Wahoo McDaniel, who can you trust?
I guess, but the reason this one worked, and I almost always agree with you on that, but because that's the rule with Austin. Remember they tried to do that once? They tried to turn turn Austin heel again,
mm-hmm.
and it just backfired on them because you mm-hmm. don't turn your heroes into bad, you know. Same thing with Wahoo, but the reason it worked here in my mind, because the two rules of this is the best and the most shocking is the same thing, because it has to be shocking. And if it's just shocking, it doesn't matter.
Right.
It has to be shocking and then inevitable, meaning you're looking back on, you're like, yeah, okay, I see exactly what happened. You know, this makes sense. And that's the case with Wahoo. It's shocking because it's Wahoo. But if you look at his reasoning, it made perfect sense.
It did make, and I definitely concede that. You know, you could see watching it why Wahoo would be so upset, and he feels like he's in the right, and he's like, you know, screw Flair, screw Steamboat, they're not doing anything for me.
And another reason it worked like it did is because of his opponent. Flair was so crazy over in the Carolinas at this point
mm-hmm.
that anybody's going to be a bad guy against him.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny. It's like Rick, you know, he'd held the title where he'd won the title for the first time like 3 years ago. And Rick was almost like he was the new legend and the old legend was kind of fighting for his spot.
Yeah, and it was part of it as well. The whole thing was just incredibly well. It should have been the Starrcade main event. The 84.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with you there, because I saw Dusty, especially in 1984. I mean, I could kind of see Wahoo was getting older when, like, the 80s started. And to me, Dusty, when you saw Dusty against Flair, especially the first time in the Carolinas, I mean, you're talking, you know, really the number one guy versus the number two guy in the NWA.
But they did nothing to build it up.
They kept Flair more or less in a babyface role. But, you know, he and Dusty had a few confrontations on Worldwide before that. But again, it was almost like, you know, you've got the clear number one against the clear number two. It's almost like this sells itself, you know?
So that was, we just covered my second and the third. So what would be your next one?
My next one is a weird one. And I say that because a lot of people aren't going to understand this. I followed Mid-Atlantic Wrestling through the magazines. And I had never seen any of these guys on TV before. So it's right around the very end of 1978. And I am at the train station in New York, different trip. This is like, you know, right after Christmas. And I buy a copy of the Wrestler magazine, which comes out earlier in New York than it did in Massachusetts. And I look, and the first thing I look is the ratings. Okay, let's see if any major titles have changed hands, that sort of thing. And I look, and the way they used to do the ratings, they did NWA, WWF, AWA tag teams, most popular and most hated. And I look, and Paul Jones is number one on the most hated list. And I'm like, what? I just remember being so taken aback by that. And I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And they used to have a column called What's Happening. And the lead story was Paul Jones had turned on Ricky Steamboat. And I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it, because I just, even though I think I knew that Paul Jones had been a heel before in Florida, but I still, you know, since I started reading the magazines like 3 years earlier, you know, Paul Jones was portrayed as a saint in these magazines, and now he's a bad guy that turns on Ricky Steamboat. So then about a month later, Inside Wrestling comes out. And there's one of their interviews with Paul Jones, the hot seat, you know, a made-up interview. But there are photographs of Paul Jones, like, chumming it up with Ric Flair, Greg Valentine, and Big John Studd, Ken Patera. To me, it was totally surreal that Paul Jones would be buddies with these guys.
Now, Paul, probably 2 years earlier, would have been Johnny Valentine's last feud, right? In 74?
I think 75. 75?
And Paul wasn't a big guy.
No,
I mean,
wasn't.
Paul. But they put him in with Valentine, and completely believable. And he completely over. I mean, he was like the guy coming to conquer the great Johnny Valentine. And, you know, again, he made it work. So he was completely over in that region. And to Paul, to you know, years and years and years later, would still defend his actions.
Yeah.
Even the kayfabe, you know, those interviews, the retrospective interviews, the Scott Teal interviews. He would still defend it. It's fantastic.
I mean, Paul Jones was over enough with me where I would not have been surprised to have opened up that magazine and learned that he'd won the NWA title. You know, I saw him as you know, that legitimate and big of a star.
Oh, he absolutely was within the 70s. I'd say from the early to like from 71 to, geez, like about 77, 78. He's absolutely top five guy. And he had multiple title shots.
So what was we've got to wrap this baby up. Believe it or not, this hour goes by incredibly quickly. What were your 3, 4, and 5?
Let's see. 3, 4, and 5 were okay, good. I have no problem mentioning Hogan this way. Hogan turned at the Bash in 96. Ole against Dusty in 1980, the big turn. In the cage, and then the Briscoes against the Youngblood and Steamboat.
Okay. Ole, I've seen, I don't know, you know, I wasn't surprised. I really didn't know what was going on until I saw that Ole had turned on Dusty. Hogan, I knew about. Hogan, I knew it was a real possibility that he was going to turn that night, you know, if Hogan okayed it. I kind of knew that coming in. The Briscoes was right up there with Paul Jones for me. Even though I knew Jack could be kind of heelish when he was defending the NWA title, you know, when he needed to be, when he was in Texas or Georgia or wherever, fighting a baby.
Not the Carolinas.
Not the Carolinas, no. So I knew he had that in a weird, like, Marcus way in him. But to see the magazines, and once again, you know, the Briscoes palling around with Harley Race and Bob, you know, Greg Valentine or whoever, it was a total shock to the system for me.
And who do you have as your last three?
Okay. Number one was Maivia. Number two was Paul Jones. Number three was Wahoo McDaniel. Number four, Rick Martel at WrestleMania. I think it was WrestleMania 5, right?
Yep.
The one in 89. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I could not ever have imagined beforehand Rick Martel in the role of a heel. I don't think he had ever been a heel before, and I just did not see it coming. And he played the role really well. I thought the model gimmick was pretty darn funny. But I did not hear about it happening before it happened. So that was the other one. My number five was Steve Austin at WrestleMania 17. This is one where I had heard it was a possibility. By then, the WWF was good enough about getting like red herrings out there to the point where you really didn't know what was going on anymore. You know, there wasn't like inside people who knew what the deal was. But I had heard it was a possibility, and it was still shocking to me for the reasons you outlined. How stupid are you guys? The fans aren't going to boo Austin. They love this guy. If they, once again, another guy you just don't turn, if you like Steve Austin that much, you know, you don't want to see him in a different role.
That's bad shocking. That's shocking
exactly.
For the sake of being shocking, and then you have nothing to do with it afterwards. That's why when you said shocking, I had to have shocking and the inevitable in it. Because if it's just shocking, what's the point? You end up doing more damage to yourself in the long run, which they did in this case.
Steve Austin was on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine in 98, and they had a lengthy article on him. And in the article, he was like, you know, oh yeah, one of these days I'm going to be the bad guy. It's just, you know, the way wrestling works, that characters need to be changed. And even then, I'm like, Steve, don't even think about it. That's not how it goes.
No, not when you get to his level. And everybody had the 316 shirts.
Yeah.
He was one of those guys that when he turned face, they really had no choice. It was like Dusty in 74, from what everyone tells me in Florida, is that Dusty just got so popular.
Uh-huh.
That, yeah, you were going to either kill the babyface part of your roster or you had to turn him.
Gordon, Dusty Rhodes, when he was a heel in Florida, reminded me of like 1981, 1982 Terry Gordy. And he was in Florida. He was like a Hacksaw Jim Duggan character, that he was such a badass heel, you knew he was going to be turned babyface at some point. You had to know.
It was the whole kind of his take on the Thunderbolt Patterson, the jive thing. That's what made him. I mean, that,
yeah.
You know, in the, plus in the ring, he was quite agile back then. He could
fly. Yeah, Dusty was a great athlete.
Yeah. I mean, even despite, you know, and he wasn't quite as big. He was a little smaller back then. Because he really didn't, when he was with Murdoch, he really didn't talk a lot.
No, that's true.
So that's kind of a late developing thing. He really didn't start getting into that until probably like 70. I remember seeing one match with him, I think it was 72, and it was against Eddie Graham. I think Paul Jones was in that match too. And Dusty was like subhuman. He was just like, just no. Well, he was like a Neanderthal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, he was like he barely spoke. He's like, he looked more like George Steele.
That's funny.
Yeah, I mean, he was just slamming his head with the chair and, you know, and this is probably 2 years, this is probably 72, 70, maybe early 73, somewhere in there. And 18
All right.
months later. But the point is that was a kind of a groundswell. That was one of those guys that was going to be, because he wasn't just turned and he's a face. There was a movement for him. Like, you could kind of feel it. You had to turn him. Same thing with Austin. Those guys,
yeah.
You don't turn back heel. You couldn't turn Dusty heel in Florida.
I loved the Austin turn, and you're right. It just made too much sense. And, I mean, when his babyface turn against Bret Hart, I thought that was masterfully delivered.
It was
but
perfect.
Anyway. Next week, we are going to have, for the first time ever, a guest on the show. And we can't tell you who it is, but we can tell you that it is someone that everyone on the Arcadian Vanguard Network knows, but it's someone who's never been a guest on an Arcadian Vanguard Network show before. So y'all know this person in wrestling, but I'm the first one to get him as a guest. Sean, we're going to have a great show next week.
I can't wait to find out who it is.
All right. Well, this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Thank you all for listening, and please tune in next week.